Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of March 4th. This week we feature two interviews about the upcoming papal transition. The first is with Father Thomas Rees, the former editor-in-chief of America. The second with Father John O'Malley. Father Rees talks about the papal transition and answers some common questions about what was going to happen over the next month. And Father O'Malley talks a bit about the history of papal resignations, looking back at Celestine V and other popes who have resigned. I began by asking Father Rees, what are the ramifications of Pope Benedict's decision to resign?
I mean, I think clearly it's going to make it much easier for a sick or elderly pope to resign from the papacy in the future. I mean, once someone like Benedict does it, it makes it much easier for someone else to do it in the future. But secondly, you know, it also raises the question, well, if you can resign because of age and sickness, well, can you resign because of other reasons? And this might influence, for example, who the cardinals choose to be the next pope. For example, right now, traditionally, they've been worried about electing a young man. And by young, I mean somebody in their early, late 50s or early 60s. That's young in the College of Cardinals. So because they were worried about that because that person could end up being pope for 30 years, and that's a long papacy, or 40 years or longer. So now there's the possibility that, okay, you could elect somebody who might be younger, and he could voluntarily step aside, resign when he reached 75 or even 80 years of age. I mean, bishops around the world resign at 75 years of age, and cardinals lose their right to vote in a conclave when they turn 80. So we don't know what's going to happen. This is going to be very interesting to watch.
And another question you pose is, will Pope Benedict try to influence the election of his successor? A lot of people are asking that these days.
I don't think so. I mean, in truth, he's already stacked the deck on who his successor is going to be because he appointed over half of the cardinals who are going to elect his successor. And he did exactly what you or I would do if we were pope. He appointed people who reflected his views about the church and reflected his position on the important issues facing the church. So whoever gets elected is going to be very much more in continuity with Pope Benedict than being a radical change in terms of policies and teachings. But in addition, I think it's interesting, for example, that he has decided once he resigns, he's heading off to Castel Gandolfo. Well, I mean, he deserves a vacation, and that is the Pope's summer home. But at the same time, symbolically, he puts that distance between him and the College of Cardinals, between him and the conclave. So he will not be present physically in the Vatican when the election is taking place, and you can bet he won't be taking any phone calls.
Now, how will the church deal with the next pope? What will he be called? What will be his powers, if any?
Well, this is a whole new area that we don't know the answers to these questions. We haven't had a ex-pope in 600 years. Now, the most famous pope that resigned was Pope Celestine V, and his successor, Pope Boniface, was so worried about an ex-pope running around that he had him arrested and thrown into a dungeon. So, now, we're certainly not going to do that to Pope Benedict. But I think that when he resigns, you know, he should lay aside the white robe of the pope. And from then on, he should be referred to as Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger. In other words, he becomes what he was before he was pope. There's no room for two popes in the Catholic Church. Whenever we've had that, we've had real problems. So I think it's important for him to, both symbolically and in reality, show that now there is only one pope, He should go to the installation and pledge his allegiance to the new pope, and then do whatever the pope tells him.
Now, there's some question of where the pope will live. I mean, I understand he's going to be living in Vatican City. I guess there's also been talk, well, should he be that close? Should he be farther away? I guess this is a point of some debate.
Yes, and frankly, I was disappointed by that announcement because, frankly, Pope Benedict can't decide where he's going to live. At least he can't decide that he's going to live in the Vatican. The Vatican belongs to the new pope, and he's going to have to get the new pope's permission before he sets up household inside the Vatican. I have no objection to him living there if he lives a quiet life. Reading his books, sitting in front of a fire, and praying for the new pope. But, I mean, frankly, usually when someone leaves a job, it's best to get out of town, go take a sabbatical, you know. But to have him physically present there, I don't think it's going to be a problem with Pope Benedict, but I think it would be a bad precedent to have ex-popes living in the Vatican. They're no longer pope. And we need to make that perfectly clear. I would rather have him move to the Benedictine Abbey, where, that St. Benedict founded. And I think since the Pope likes the name Benedict and has a devotion to him, that might be a good place for him to go.
Now, there's some question of whether the Pope will publish, will write. Is there any thought? Because he did publish, of course, not as pope, but you know, he wrote some books that of his own while he was in the papacy. So there's that question too.
Yes. Yeah, so this is the first pope who ever published a book while he was pope, and in the introduction to the books, he made very clear that he was speaking as a theologian, not as pope, which is extraordinary. We haven't had that done before. Now, once he retires, I would think he'd probably want to continue to write. Now, I think the problem with that is journalists will look at whatever the Cardinal Ratzinger, as I would like to refer to him as, what he has to say, and then compare that with what the new pope says. So, I mean, you can see the headlines. Pope Benedict says X, but the new pope says Y. And that could be very confusing to people. So I'm not sure how that is going to work. There's been some discussion, for example, of what's going to happen to this encyclical that, on faith that he has been working on. As you know, he did an encyclical on love, Deus Caritas Est, and then he did an encyclical on hope. And we've all been waiting for the encyclical on faith. Well, it's not going to be done before he retires. So is he going to take that home with him and then turn it into a book? Or is it going to sit on the desk of the new pope to be dealt with however he wants to? I mean, Pope Benedict, for example, the second half of his Deus Caritas Est was clearly written prior to him becoming pope. It was written during the papacy of John Paul II.
Now, you've been interviewed widely, not surprisingly, the last couple of days, and saw a quote where you said, even though there's been a lot of talk of a potential pope from Latin America or Africa, the chances, there's a strong chance that it'll be somebody from Europe. Is that what your belief is?
Well, a majority of the cardinals are from Europe, so if you're a betting man, you'd have to say, well, it looks like Europe has the better chance of getting elected. You know, there's two theories going on here. One theory is, let's look to Southern Africa, where the church is growing and is vibrant and where it has all sorts of converts. The other view is, well, that's fine, but, you know, the church in Africa is doing wonderfully. Leave it alone. The real problem is the church in the first world, where we're losing numbers. One out of three Catholics who were raised... people who were raised Catholics in the United States have left the church. And in Europe, there's hardly any, you know, it's become very secular and people have left religion. So, you know, that argument says we need somebody with some expertise on how to preach the gospel in the first world. Because the challenge, of course, is the Pope is how to figure out how to preach the gospel in a way that's understandable and attractive to people in the 21st century. And that's a real challenge.
So do you think this will be an extended conclave, or is really no way to tell?
Well, of course, the last conclave was very short, 24 hours, and Cardinal Ratzinger was elected. You know, I would be surprised if it went over 3 days. I mean, so far there's no real leader, that's become apparent among the cardinals. But, you know, they've got lots of time to talk about it before the conclave starts. I mean, almost a whole month from the time that the Pope announced he was going to resign until the conclave meets, probably around March 15th. So, I'm sure the telephone are ringing all over between the cardinals, and there's going to be lots of conversations over pasta in Rome about who should be the next pope. So they're going to have a lot of time to discuss this before they go into the conclave, and perhaps by then, one or two candidates will surface who become the apparent leaders. But there's always the chance that the two leaders will block each other, because it still requires a two-thirds vote to get elected pope. And then that's when you never know where they might have to look at someone else as a compromise. So it's not, it's not either group's first choice, but it's someone who's acceptable to a two-thirds majority of the conclave.
Well, this will be very interesting to follow, and Father Tom Reese will be updating the page, americamagazine.org/papal-transition, and understand you'll also be in Rome, so we look forward to hearing from you.
Great, thanks. Nice talking to you.
Father Malley, what can you tell us about Pope Celestine V, who we've heard so much about over the last few days?
Well, he was elected by a group of 12 cardinals in 1294 after a conclave that went on for over 2 years. And he was a compromise. They went outside the conclave. He was a hermit and a holy man. And they wanted to elect a holy man. They were proud of themselves for having done so. But he was totally unequal to the job. I mean, he could barely read Latin. He was overwhelmed by, he'd never had any administration. He was overwhelmed by everything. And he's almost became the prisoner of the King of Naples, Charles of Anjou. So he never set foot in Rome. He spent all his time in Naples. And so there was a lot of unrest in the among the cardinals. And finally, on December the 13th, 1294, he resigned. Was he under pressure? Some people would argue that the cardinals really were applying pressure to him to resign. But I think one could say that it's pretty close to a free resignation, if not altogether free.
There's some discussion recently that his resignation, I mean, for example, supposedly Dante cited him in the Inferno and consigned him to hell for this action.
Well, here's the thing. There was at the time this big discussion, can a pope resign? I mean, the resignation was sort of suspect in some quarters, and Dante did not at all like Celestine's successor, Boniface VIII, and so he put Celestine in hell because of il gran rifiuto, the great refusal, his refusal to accept his responsibility. And his refusal paved the way for Boniface VIII to become pope. So that's sort of the background for Boniface. I mean, for Celestine, however, when about 20 years later, he was canonized. So he is Saint Celestine V. This was done by the successor to Boniface VIII. So it's a big back and forth with poor old Celestine.
So had public opinion shifted that quickly about him and his
Well,
pages?
No, it was actually a lot of pressure. The Clement the Fifth, who was elected, he was not a cardinal. He was he had a very difficult conclave. He was Archbishop of Bordeaux and was French, never quite got to Rome, and was under great pressure by the King of France to posthumously depose Boniface VIII and denounce him, and as a kind of sop to the King of France, canonize Celestin. So it's a very complicated story.
Now, the other pope that's been cited recently, Gregory the VII. What were the circumstances that led to his resignation?
Gregory the Sixth.
Sixth, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, that was the poor bishop of Rome during the 10th century and into the 11th century had fallen. The bishopric had fallen into the hands of local nobles. So it was at its very, very lowest ebb of papal pontificates. So the what had happened was he was Benedict the Ninth was seems to have been duly elected, but was again very unworthy of the office. He made a lot of enemies, very licentious life, and finally was persuaded to resign, but resign for an exchange of money. So the next pope was Gregory the Seventh, or Gregory the Sixth. I'm sorry. And so there's a question about whether he was really legitimately the pope, because his election, one could argue, was done through simony. Then a third person, so you had Benedict the Ninth, you had Gregory the Sixth on the scene, and then all at once out of the woodwork comes a man named Sylvester the Third, who also was claiming to be pope. So you had three popes, and that was settled by a synod that, in effect, deposed them all. So yes, Benedict the Ninth's resignation seems to have been free, but not really legitimate, not really above board, not really moral, not really ethical.
So that's why we're hearing some different names here from the media, is because it's unclear who actually was forced to resign, who did it willingly, because it was so infrequent.
Yeah, so I mean, I can count 9 or 10 potential that things that look like are somehow or other papal resignations, but just how many of them were really free is questionable. I mean, you can argue one way or the other in so many of these cases.
Well, as you talk, and you also wrote back in 2005 when we had the last conclave, that there's a lot of intrigue surrounding these conclaves. Was it because, I mean, this was such an important political role as well as a religious role, that's why their people were vying for power in this way?
Yes, it was not only simply a religious role and political, it also had a lot of economic and social benefits for the
sure.
person. So you could, once you became pope, you really had disposition of all the resources of the Roman Church, which were considerable. So, and then you could ennoble your family, and this was, so it was a prize that was... You had a lot of unworthy people vying for it for unworthy reasons. So there have been, ever since the conclave came into existence in 1274, there have been reforms. So, and we've seen some in the last 40 years or so, not major ones, but tinkering with the process.
Now, you write in your piece for America that there were some major reforms back in the 19th century because there were still... I guess some secular rulers who had some veto power over the conclave?
Right. That had developed in the 17th century when the great powers, namely great Catholic powers, namely Spain, France, and the Holy Roman Empire, all began to claim that they had they could veto one candidate. And so they had a veto power over a candidate, and they exercised it. Because somebody who was unfavorable to them for some reason or another. And the last time, as you know, that was exercised was in 1903, at the time when Pius X was elected. The Roman emperor, that is to say, was in Vienna, vetoed Cardinal Rampolla. And that was really the end. The cardinals were furious, and they... made it absolutely impossible that to happen again. And then the political situation in Europe changed dramatically with the First World War, so it just kind of disappeared.
Now, of course, the intrigue, we haven't seen anything like this over the last century, since, as you say, 1903. It doesn't seem like a coincidence that once the political state of the Vatican was less powerful, that these intrigues kind of, there weren't any.
That's right. You know, that the seizure of the Papal States and then of Rome in 1870 changed everything. And the popes no longer had any kind of temporal rule except over the small little city-state. So that did change everything. And we've seen nothing. None of these became much, it was not a political ploy at all in terms of the nation-states and so forth that we have today.
Now, you mentioned some of these recent changes. These are just, as you said, tinkering, a kind of minor
right,
changes.
Right, yes, minor changes. I mean, who can vote? I mean, this whole age issue, how old do you, can you be elected pope after you're 80 and all those sorts of things. So they're really, I think every pope since, oh, certainly Pius XII made changes. I think John the 23rd did, certainly Paul the 6th did, John Paul the 2nd did, and Benedict the 16th has. So there you go.
Well, Father O'Malley, thank you for illuminating some of this history for us, and we look forward to some of your continuing commentary for America.
Okay, thank you very much.